The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. In this week's podcast, we get bad on yo ass, it says here, with a timely Beastie Boys special. Their new long player Hot Sauce Committee Part 2 cops the full power of our coruscating critical analysis. And we look back fully 25 years at the Beastie's breakthrough record License to Ill. 25 years, God, really that old. Plus, there are new tracks from Gang Gang Dance, Cosmo Jarvis and Tom Veck. All to come in Music Weekly from The Guardian. Hello again. Joining me in the broiling furnace of the pod is Rosie Swash. Hello, Rosie.
Hello.
How are you doing? Have you seen we're on the front page of the iTunes store?
Are we? You and I? Horrible.
Yeah, The one where it looks like I'm about to sort of molest you. And there's another picture of me on my own where I look like a sort of sex case. And this is supposed to entice people to not even part with money. It looks like the picture looks like one of those adverts for Centrepoint where it goes, you know, Rosie is homeless and scared and the predatory men, you're £5. Anyway, a big welcome for the first time, I think, in the pod to Mr. Angus Beatty. How are you doing, Angus?
Very well. Yourselves?
All right, apart from the whole iTunes situation. Let's get straight in to what we're here to talk about, which is the new offering from the Beastie Boys. And Angus, you're a long-term fan.
Absolutely.
Really, from back in the days?
From back in the days.
I'm using the language.
You are. Yeah. slipping into it.
What was it that appealed to you about the Beastie Boys? Were they kind of a gateway band into hip-hop for you, or were you already a big hip-hop fan when they came along?
I was already a fan. I wouldn't say necessarily a big fan. It was a music that I'd started to listen to before they came along. John Peel was my gateway into hip-hop, and he played, he did play some of the Beastie's stuff of the License to Ill era, particularly the track Hold It Now, Hit It, which, if you hear that out of context of the album, it just sounded like a great hip-hop track of that era, of regardless of anything else. So that was my way into listening to them, was through John Peel playing Hold It Now, Hit It.
And what do you think about Hot Sauce Committee Part 2? 25 years on, still relevant, still slightly pained? Is that a slightly pained expression crossing your face? Or is that an expression of pure delight?
In a sense, I don't think they've ever made a bad album, so that this one isn't a bad album.
Right.
I actually think this is a very good album of theirs. It's difficult to tell whether it's one of their 4-star albums or 5-star albums.
Right.
I love it, but I could understand why people might think, well, they've been around for such a long time, what possible relevance can they have? Mm-hmm. Do understand that point of view, but I don't. It's not one that's ever crossed my mind.
Do they have relevance within hip-hop?
Absolutely.
You think so? Because it strikes me they're a completely separate entity from the rest of the world of hip-hop now, the Beastie Boys. The different audience, you know what I mean? They're not appealing to the same people that, say, Lil Wayne is appealing to.
Well, no, they're not, and personally, thank God for that. I mean, I no disrespect to Lil Wayne, who has his place and all the rest of it, but no, they're not part of mainstream hip-hop. They probably were for a time in the 80s, maybe a little bit in the 90s, but they've always had huge respect from within the hip-hop community, certainly amongst other artists. So we can see on this album, they've got Nas guesting with them now, of all people that they could have got. I mean, he's not just playing along. He's not just being paid, you know, so many thousand dollars to turn up and phone in a guest appearance. He's genuinely hymning their greatness on that track. Mm-hmm. On my iPod shuffle the other day, an old Eric Sermon track from 1993 came up called Stay Real, where he talks about how he comes from an era of hip-hop when hip-hop was real. And it was, he says in the lyrics something like, it was the era of the Beasties, Stetzer, Jazzy Jeff, LL. You know, and he name checks all of these people who were iconic and important in the late 80s period when hip-hop made its breakthrough from being an underground New York music to a global important phenomenon. And the Beasties are in his estimation, every bit as much a part of that as the Public Enemies or the Eric B. and Rakim's.
Yeah. And Angus, your choice of standout track?
I'd like to choose the single Make Some Noise. I think it's fantastic. It's the first track on the album. It's an obvious good starting point, and it's got the most insane video ever produced. Have you heard about this video?
I haven't seen the video, no.
20 minutes long, it stars a selection of Hollywood greats starring as two different lineups of the Beastie Boys circa 1986.
Wow, like who? Who's in it?
Will Ferrell, Jack Black,
Guy from The Hobbit.
Yeah.
What's his
the little
name?
Fella. Yeah. That's enough people that are in the video. Let's hear the track. Okay, Rosie, are you a Beastie Boys fan? Do you like this album?
My brother was really into them.
Mm.
And then by the time they meant anything to me was Hello Nasty, which came
right
across at... Well, no, yeah, but I mean, it came, part more than anything else, because it came along at a time where it was just, it stuck out like a sore thumb compared to the rest of the stuff that was around in the late 90s. Again, this album, like I was saying with Hello Nasty, sticks out in regard to the... If you look at some of the other rappers that people seem to be talking about the most at the moment, like Odd Future or Wiz Khalifa or Lil B, it's so consciously harking back to the old days. It sounds really old school. Mm. It's really old school. And also their vocals on it, which kind of confused me at first, because the effect is to have them so distant from the track, almost at the back of the track. It's quite odd. And I feel like there's a sense of them trying to position themselves away from everything else that's happening in hip-hop and saying we're going to do something a little bit different, which is quite different from Sabotage or, you know, Intergalactic and stuff, which always sounded different from everything that they'd done before.
I think that's a really interesting point. Hip-hop used to be music that was predicated entirely on looking forward. You know, the highest compliment you could pay a record was to call it fresh. You know what I mean? This kind of retrospection, this kind of looking back, is that a good thing for hip-hop, Angus? Is that...
I would debate whether this is a retro record.
Okay.
I think they've always looked to the future, but they've looked to remake their past and the past of their music in the future, if you see what I mean. You mentioned Wiz Khalifa, and I've been listening to his record recently because I had to write about that for somebody other than The Guardian, and I've got no bones to pick with Wiz Khalifa as an artist at all, but it depresses me thoroughly to think that there are people who perceive that the record that he's made is hip-hop or representative of what hip-hop is or should be about. It's a very small, infinitesimally small segment of what hip-hop is. Hip-hop, actually, if you go back to the era that the Beasties come from and before that, when people were making music by getting two copies of the same record and rapping over it in a live situation, before there were even rap records, hip-hop was other music. It was everything that had come before it. And the Beasties have come out of that era. Their rhymes and the way that they write and the way that they approach recording, song structure anyway, is definitely what you would describe as old school in inverted commas. The Wiz Khalifa record concerns itself with you know, themes of disrespecting women, making as much money as possible, giving that money to his friends and making him look good by the fact that he's giving that money to his friends. There's nothing else to say on that record. No. It sounds like every other record.
But that's a charge you could level at an enormous amount of hip-hop, isn't it? I mean,
well, I'm sure it is, but that doesn't mean that that is all that hip-hop is.
No, sure.
And so to have a record that reminds us perhaps that hip-hop can be more than that is to me a godsend. That's why I'm very excited by this Beastie Boys record at this particular moment in time, even though it's had its troubles and it's been effectively on the shelf for 2 years because of Adam Yak's illness. 2 years ago, this record existed in more or less the same form that it exists now, but it was postponed because Adam Yak got ill. They called in Philippe Zadar to remix it because they felt that the mix that they'd done, which they'd done themselves, perhaps didn't, you know, they were happy with the songs, but they weren't as happy with the overall sound of the record.
Sorry to interrupt. Was Philippe Zadar isn't the guy from Motorbass? Are we talking about the French
guy,
house producer?
Yeah, the associate of Justice and all of those.
Interesting choice,
yes,
a producer for a hip-hop record.
Well, he has a background in French hip-hop. There's been a huge hip-hop scene in France for years.
Mm.
He came out of a hip-hop background and has been making these sort of pop dance kind of records with the Ed Banger people. Mm. Was recommended to the Beasties by friends in another band, and it's the first time they've really worked with anybody from outside. I mean, if you go back to their usual list of collaborators, people like Keyboard Money Mark, he was a carpenter and he came to repair some furniture when they were making Paul's Boutique. So, you know, they've always had people that they know work on their records, and here's somebody coming from outside, and there was a risk inherent in that, I guess.
So, Rosie, what is your favourite track from the album? Let's hear it.
Well, my favourite track is actually an instrumental called Multilateral Nuclear Agreement.
Wicked.
Rolls off the tongue. The last record after Five Boroughs was an instrumental, I think. It's the mix-up. So it's very good.
Final question. Hip-hop talks a lot about back in the day, the golden era and all this kind of thing. It doesn't do very well as a scene at curating the ongoing careers of artists from that era. And the Beastie Boys, I mean, LL Cool J is still, you know, making records. The Beastie Boys are still making records. Public Enemy are making records in obviously an enormously reduced circumstances to what they were. I mean, it's on the internet and that kind of thing. A lot of the other big names from that era and from the sort of era before can't get record deals, perform at kind of nostalgia nights and stuff like that. Why do you think the Beastie Boys have continued? Why is their career successful in a way that others aren't?
In a sense, part of it is because while being part of this continuum of the old school, they've also been somewhat to one side of it. They are the band that all bands want to be, because you go and see them play and they will go from performing rambunctious songs from Licensed to Ill into something much more intricate, maybe from Paul's Boutique, into hardcore punk, into loungecore jazz. They can do anything they want. They've created their own little space, and they've also built their own brand where they can market themselves, if you like, to their own fan base much more effectively. A lot of artists, particularly from that late 80s era, maybe haven't really grasped that side of it. They've concentrated more on the music and maybe moaning about how the music isn't selling as well as it should be.
Absolutely. We're going to talk a bit later about, well, one of the golden ages of hip-hop. But for the time being, Beastie Boys' album Hot Sauce Committee Part 2 is out on Monday. Okay, and now it's time for Singles Club. You know the drill by now. Each of us brings in a track soon to be released or just been released that we like. Let's begin with Rosie's choice. And you're the one. Okay, that's A Chore by Tom Beck, the intriguingly named comeback single. Rosie, your choice, you brought it in. Tell us why.
I'm quite intrigued by Tom Beck, who kind of popped up in about 2005 with a very good album called We Have Sound. He then completely disappeared.
That album was very hotly tipped.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then clearly didn't do anything. One of the things I find intriguing about Tom Beck's comeback is that it seems to be people like, whoa, Tom Beck's back. And it's like, well, nobody bought your first album. What's all that about?
It's very strange. I think of the 2005 bands that sounded a bit like him, there was the Claw. Do you remember Claw?
Yeah.
All the big names, Cut Copy, all these bands that have since disappeared. And he was the one who, I only just discovered what he looked like. He really was very removed from the music. And then he just disappears. And there was all these kind of semi tongue-in-cheek Facebook campaigns of where is Tom Beck and is Tom Beck coming back? And I really like this, but it feels like exactly the same stuff that he was doing in 2005.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, I agree. I mean, I do like it. I liked his stuff then. I like this now. It doesn't strike me as a huge progression. But then again, seeing as nobody really went for it in 2005, there is a sort of, you know, there can be a benefit in standing still and just waiting for other people to catch up with what you're doing or waiting for the climate to change. It seems quite now. Angus?
I thought this was a really interesting song. It seems to be a breakup song, but it's a very abstract breakup song that goes further than one would tend to find most breakup songwriters going. At first, when I listened to it on computer tinny little speaker, I just thought that this is an odd and horrible out-of-tune vocal, but then I listened to it properly on headphones where you could hear the bass and the full arrangement and get some sense of the scope of the production, and it all makes perfect sense. It's a song coming from a very anguished place, and the vocal seems to reflect that. No, I was very impressed by it.
Excellent, excellent. Well, A Chore by Tom Beck. It's a brave title for your comeback single, calling it A Chore. Johnny Marr on the first album by Johnny Marr and the Healers. There was an 11-minute track called Banging On. anyway, he'll be touring in June. The track is out now. Next up, it's My Choice.
Yes.
That's a very little bit of my choice for this week's podcast, which goes on for about 3 weeks. Glass Jar by Gang Gang Dance, the opening track from the new album. I had previously ignored Gang Gang Dance to a degree because they always struck me as the kind of band you would admire rather than adore. And it always struck me, yeah, it's going to be really hard work, this music. It's all these things stuck together and it's this, that and the other and da 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 da. And then this started circulating, this track, on the internet in March, I think. And I thought, I'll have a little listen to that and see what it's like. Because, you know, their last album was very widely acclaimed. And sort of widely acclaimed by people outside, you know, dance, you know, Fact magazine and people like that. People more interested probably in dance music than guitar rock. And I just thought this was great. I thought this was a really intriguing piece of music. I like the fact that it sets its stall out in the opening kind of seconds by having some sort of sample of a voice going, it's everything time. And that is sort of what this track, and indeed the rest of the album, is quite like. It's just a sort of kaleidoscope of influences. But it's done in kind of quite a measured way, I thought. I like the fact that it unfolds into something. It spends 11 minutes turning into something else in the way that a track by Lindstrom or a sort of dance producer like that would. Rosie, was this for you? Did this do anything for you? Summer's day music. Sunny afternoon music.
Well, I remember when this did surface, it was like, that's an interesting way to queue up your new album with an 11-minute track.
I think it's interesting in that a lot of bands of their ilk, kind of hipster, experimental, sort of art rock American bands have kind of made much more commercial records.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to bring up the subject of Yay Say It Again, but they seem to be
Animal Collective.
You know, and this seems to be very much a line in the sand going, we are not, you know, making a record like...
Exactly, but that's why I don't like it. I mean, this is what I always had the same impression of Gang Gang Dance that you did, that I just thought, you know, I mean, I remember reading this ludicrous review of it in a online magazine, which shall remain nameless, where the person had got totally carried away and almost written it in a fictional form, and it was all about their...
Ah, so it was a bad idea.
You know, their...
people come to you looking for writing tips. Write your review in a fictional form.
Started off with him falling in love as a teenager, and then the album...
No one cares what happens to you when you're a teenager, mate.
It's like when people start writing and they want to do a live review, and they're like, I got the bus.
Yeah.
It was cold. I had my scarf on.
Don't tell us what happened in the queue, you know?
And so, like you, I just kind of thought, I think they're a bit hipster than now, and I don't think there's much there that interests me, and I think that their peers and their contemporaries have grasped the idea of having a pop hook, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and this hasn't really changed my mind.
Okay, interesting. Angus, did this do anything for you?
Well, I had all of Rosie's preconceptions, but that was after listening to the track. I take entirely your point, Alexis, about all of the episodic nature, and I do like the idea that people can do that, and I listen to a lot of songs that are longer than 3 minutes, and I applaud them for having the ambition to craft something longer, and I do like the way that it does change. But the problem for me is that in a piece of music, a largely instrumental piece of music of this nature, I need something to grab hold of as I'm going along, and I don't find it in there. When the words experimental and hipster are evoked, that probably helps to explain perhaps my lack of engagement with it.
There you go. Well, I liked it. Anyway, that's Gang Gang Dance, Glass Jar, which is on their forthcoming album, Eye Contact, which is out a week on Monday. But you can find that track all over the internet if you look for it. Okay, final track this week is from Angus. I guess I do. This car park's only got one space and it's for you. Alone can show an ugly face, so I'll be alright. Sure as hell not Jesus, but you saved me. Thank you. That's Sure as Hell Not Jesus by Cosmo Jarvis. Your choice, Angus.
Yes. Not that I'm trying to do any kind of multimedia brand extension marketing exercise, but Cosmo Jarvis is somebody else that I've been writing about recently. Cosmo Jarvis is, I believe him to be one of the most potentially important and certainly one of the most fascinating new artists around at the moment.
Wow, bold claim, why?
All sorts of reasons. He's about 20 years old. He's already written 300 songs. He directs his own videos. He directs short films. He writes. He acts. He does 101 different things. His first album, it was a double CD released by Wall of Sound about 2 years ago, called Hummers You Hitch, Son of a Bitch. The first half of it was a series of largely whimsical songs, stuff about how he was in love with Jessica Alba and wanted to marry her. The second half was all about his childhood, which was in an extremely dysfunctional family, some amazing songs, some amazingly open and honest songwriting, in an absolute plethora of different musical styles. He'll try anything to make it sound interesting. Mm. That's made him very difficult to pigeonhole and consequently difficult to sell. The first single from the new album was called Gay Pirates.
Which this is one that Stephen Fry liked, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. A great song, but almost something you would hear a band like the Pogues doing in 1990, and written quite deliberately because Cosmo, who is not gay, wanted to write a song that leery, beard-up lads would find themselves singing along to without realising that it was an anthem about gay sex.
Wow.
He just thought that would be an interesting thing to do. And it's caught on. He's got quite a lot of attention for that, as you say, Stephen Fry, various other people, lots of YouTube plays, and a broadening out of his still small but growing fan base. But I'd like this single. The song has just gone onto YouTube with a video that he's made, which is about something completely different. The song is a relationship song, but the video is about child abuse within the Catholic Church.
Wow. Rosie?
I agree that. I think it's a really interesting, exciting prospect, and I think the thing about Gay Pirates was it wasn't gimmicky at all. You could just tell that instantly, and it was a great video because it didn't shy away from it. It wasn't like, well, let's talk about being gay, but let's not actually have two men touching each other or anything like that. It really went for it. The only thing I would say is he's got that feeling of a lyricist that's got a little bit too much to say and hasn't quite kind of honed it yet. But in a lot of ways, he reminds me of Jeffrey Lewis.
I was just about to say Jeffrey Lewis, yeah. Aren't you? I was just about to say he sounds like an English version of Jeffrey Lewis.
Very similar, who I think with Jeffrey Lewis and possibly with Cosmo Jarvis, I always find a little bit more interesting than I actually, you know what I mean? I think interesting thing to listen to, but not because of the music, because of the power and the gift of his storytelling and just like how he can make the weird seem so accessible and that kind of thing. And he's definitely got that skill. So good luck to him, and I hope he does well.
I completely agree. I completely agree with the comparison to Jeffrey Lewis. I think, I mean, I'm a massive Jeffrey Lewis fan, and even the most diehard Jeffrey Lewis fan thinks, God, you know, you could use a little bit more time in the whole editing process here, Jeff. But the good bits are just amazing, and, you know, as you say, really gifted in storytelling. I feel almost exactly the same way about Cosmo Jarvis. And there's almost too much going on, but there are worse crimes than trying a bit too hard at a time when most people aren't trying at all, you know?
And I'd much rather he was trying too hard than not, than trying to do something that was identical.
No, I completely agree. I completely agree. Artists like him and like Jeffrey Lewis, you know, to use a sort of terrible old hippie phrase, you've got to go with the whole trip, you know, and you've got to find the bits that you like out of it. He puts a lot of stuff out there, you know, and you can take what you want from it. I thought this was a really good single. I loved it. Sure as Hell Not Jesus by Cosmo Jarvis is out. Do we know when it's out?
29th of May, if that's a Monday.
29th of May.
And the video's on YouTube now, along with large numbers of Cosmo's own movies and past videos on his channel. There's some amazing stuff to look at there.
Amazing. Check it out. Okay, some tweets and comments from last week's show before we move on. Dave Portivo said, "Brother, not that interesting, not that good. In my opinion, rock/indie is waiting for a counter Lady Gaga/Kanye West, someone who is going to boldly set the artistic/cultural/commercial agenda. The anti-Arctic Monkeys, as it were." Interesting point. Matt Nuff. "For once, Liam Gallagher was right on the money when he described them as posh boys with tattoos, because that is how they come across. I would rather listen to the Blue Tones any day." that's not a sentence you hear very often, so well done, Matt Nuff, for coming with an original point. Thanks for the comments this week. And the retweets. You can follow us at Music Weekly Pod, all one word, or you can leave a longer comment on the blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Next, we roll back to 1986. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was born. Hooray! The C86, the NME cassette compilation was released, which I bought.
Oh.
I was 14. And quickly became a genre of its own, sort of. Yes, that's true. And the Voyager 2 space probe made its first encounter with Uranus. Hey, Beastie Boys style joke. Coming from Uranus to Checkmouse style. Angus, why was 1986 such a big year for hip-hop?
If nothing else had happened in 1986, other than the release of Raising Hell by Run DMC, then 1986 would still be a seismic year in hip-hop history. We mentioned the Golden Age before, and there are debates and arguments about what the Golden Age is and what its parameters are and all the rest of it, but the classicist hip-hop fans' view on the Golden Age is that the Golden Age began with the release of Raising Hell in 1986, and it came to a close with the release of The Chronic by Dr. Dre in 1992. So this was the start of hip-hop's Golden Age, and during those years, a great number of fantastic records were made in a sample-based form.
Shall we hear one of them? What should we hear?
How about Ego Trippin' by the Ultramagnetic MCs?
Party people's in the place to be. Just for you, it's the Ultramagnetic MCs.
Ego Tripping by the Ultramagnetic MCs, a track from 1986, which we're holding up as a golden age, or the start of a golden age of hip-hop. Why was the Run DMC album so important? Everyone talks about the single, everyone talks about Walk This Way, and it got an MTV and da-da, but it's not just, it strikes me as being about a lot more than just getting sort of Aerosmith fans to listen to a hip-hop record.
Oh no, completely. It did broaden hip-hop out beyond a sort of a core fan base that had already started to take interest. It also changed the sort of the direction of the way that the music was developing. There was a lot more production in an electronic style. Mm. We might be listening to Mantronics in a few minutes, I don't know, but they were sort of the end of a dying breed of people who used electronic programming style production predominantly, and it went back to this what was even then looked on as an old school way of working by using samples from two copies of the same record. Peter Piper on the first track on Raising Hell is an old DJ trick that's been done for years in hip-hop park jams, even before Run DMC recorded it, using two copies of an old Bob James jazz cover of Paul Simon's Take Me to the Mardi Gras, bouncing from one to the other with that cowbell thing going on, and then rapping over it. So these were taking these old routines, that the essence of hip-hop, even in 1986, that was seen as, you know, harking back to the roots of the genre, putting them front and centre in a way that they'd never been before. Mm. You also had a completely different style. Run and DMC were shouting, and they were aggressive, and they were, there was bravado. Rappers had always had a lot of talking about themselves, but there was a real chest-beating sense about Run DMC and the way that they worked. Okay, they did, this was their third album, they'd been doing it before, but this was where everything seemed to catalyse and make sense in a new way, and it was like an explosive impact that broadened hip-hop out.
Rosie, you were like two or something.
Four.
Amazing. Did any of this music impact on you? Obviously not at age four. I sincerely doubt you were listening to like Schoolie D or something.
My brother probably was, but no. I have to. We've been doing the both Angus and I have been contributing a bit to a forthcoming supplement that the Guardian's putting out as part of their genre supplement.
Oh yes, yes, I'll
yes. There's a look
too.
Of joy passes across your face, and we're doing the hip hop and R&B one. So it's been really enjoyable researching and looking at that period. But my favourite rap album ever is Illmatic by Nas, which is invested a lot in this era of music, and also captures maybe a little bit of what you're talking about. It was 94, was it out? So again, the other disputed golden age of hip-hop, age.
Yeah, I would say it was the second golden age.
And
it
captures that kind of, you know, the way he raps about Roxanne Shanti, and he raps about, but he was also raps in a kind of way of like, look, I'm really interested in Gucci shades, but what's wrong with me? Is that the right thing? And it captures that tipping point before hip-hop fully went that way. And I remember hearing those lyrics and thinking, what's he talking about, Roxanne Shanti, and going back and kind of investigating it. So that was the way I came to it.
No, it was certainly the year for me that hip-hop started to impact on me, for exactly the same reasons as you, because John Peel started playing. Or I'm sure he'd been playing stuff before that, but actually the year I started listening to John Peel, I was 14. So it was a slightly peculiar thing in that I was an indie kid. I mean, I was a proper bowl haircutted cutie, as they used to be known in 1986. On the other hand, things like the sort of title track of Raising Hell, you would hear on like the Andy Kershaw show. I remember thinking, this sounds amazing. And it suddenly seemed very accessible, and it was getting written about an awful lot in the music press at the time. And there did appear to be a really massive variety of music around available that was coming out under the banner of hip hop at the time. Let's hear Bassline by Mantronics.
Love my
So Angus, where does License to Ill fit in with all of this? Because this is theoretically what this is being pegged on. It's the celebration of 25 years, the silver jubilee of License to Ill. Where does this fit in?
The funny thing is that for all of it standing to one side, in a sense, that these are white guys making black music at a time where very few white people were involved as makers of hip-hop. I think one of the things that stands up now when you look back to License to Ill is how much of its time and how much of a great hip-hop record of 1986 vintage this record was. Beasties were fundamentally involved in some of the most important hip-hop music being made in New York in 1985, 86, 87. They were friends of Rick Rubin before he founded Def Jam. Rick Rubin was their DJ initially. They released two of the first singles on Def Jam, their own, and also MCA did a solo single, which everyone's forgotten about nowadays, but which was called Drum Machine and was fantastic. LL Cool J, who was signed to Def Jam and released their first record solely because LL had sent this demo tape in of I Need a Beat to Rick Rubin, and it had arrived in this pile inside Rick Rubin's dorm room in the New York University where he was living at the time, and Ad Rock, Adam Horovitz from the Beasties, found LL's tape among the junk and played it and said to Rick, you should do something with this.
Wow.
So the Beasties discovered LL Cool J. Also, Run DMC wrote several songs that are on License to Ill, so that there's an authenticity about it. It wasn't some guys playing at this stuff. They had come from a punk rock background. They were Manhattan white guys, and they were interested in this culture, but they weren't tourists. They were very much a part of what was going on, and what they did was real. Mm. And that, to me, when you listen to License to Ill, that's exactly what comes out of that record, is it's absolute immersion in the culture that it was part of, and its honesty about that culture.
They soon outgrew that culture, it struck me. Not, I mean, not maybe with themselves, but as a phenomenon, they outgrew that culture, because initially I remember License to Ill coming out and seeing it as very much part of a wider thing. It was Album of the Year in Melody Maker in 1986. There you go, amazing. Within about a year, they had become a kind of phenomenal success that didn't really seem to have anything to do with hip-hop at all, and there was a lot of tabloid furore, etc., etc., particularly in England, seemed to be the issue. What effect do you think that had on them as a band?
It was probably the making of them in some respects. Mm. The tabloid furore caused a number of things. It was directly responsible for a riot that ensued at a gig in Liverpool in 1987. All of that probably caused them to just think, well, hang on a minute, there's part of what we're doing is music, and part of what we're doing is a sort of performance art. Mm. You know, it's fun, but this isn't fun anymore. Mm. They also had a huge battle with Def Jam and ended up leaving the label. They were delayed in making any new records, but that begat a pattern that's gone on. I mean, they've only made eight albums in
25 years.
So they've always had big gaps between things. But I think it also brought home to them, you know, they don't want to be pushed into any one corner or typecast by their audience. Mm. A lot of that stuff wasn't their fault. You couldn't really say that it created an image and it was a bratty, obnoxious image, but I don't think that they wanted to be pelted with beer cans and charged with assault while on stage in the UK. So this need to sort of reinvent manifested itself with Paul's Boutique, and then Check Your Head in 1992, where they went back to their punk roots, played instruments, became this band who could do anything that they wanted. Mm. And they've carved this little space out for themselves, which they've managed to keep reinventing themselves and keep doing something that feels authentic to them. And that's what's kept them so popular with their fans.
What you were saying about them shaking off their image and reinventing, there was that period where they, you know, probably took on the guise of what they thought they should be doing as, you know, party guys.
Are we talking about the song Girls here?
Yeah, that and just their generally their treatment. I mean, they used to have women in dancing in cages on stage and, you know, not unlike a lot of stuff that happens, not just in hip hop. You know, they kind of totally distance themselves from that image. Mm-hmm. Ad Rock is married to Kathleen Hanna. And definitely licensed it always before the period where they started to develop a bit more consciousness about what they were doing.
They tried to talk the Prodigy out of performing Smack My Bitch Up.
Yeah,
Well, and they've, you know, well, they organise a series of Tibetan freedom concerts. Adam Yak's a Buddhist. He's now a vegan. There's always been a bigger dimension to them. And anybody who made the mistake of thinking that absolutely every single facet of what was represented in the grooves of License to Ill represented the beginning and end of the people who were making it was going to be in for a shock anyway. But, you know, I think it's a shame if we take that kind of reductive view. It's what, going back to Wiz Khalifa, I'm sure that Wiz Khalifa is not the person that he represents on that record. I certainly hope not, because he'd be a very unpleasant person indeed. But I guess they make something that's a part of what they are. They can't put the totality of who they are into things, and that was who they were portraying at that time, you know.
Okay, well, that's all we can squeeze into this Beastie Boys special edition. Thank you to Rosie and Angus for coming in. We'll be back next Friday. I'm Alexis Petridis. This podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.